do you define, you know, the making of an installation? I mean, if it's fairly unique or not very common in India?
In the sense that a lot of the sculpture in India is still pedestal sculpture. And a lot of the sculpture in India is in bronze or in marble. And you know, in sort of very permanent materials, which is, I think, maybe left over from the colonial period, because we don't really have tradition of pedestal sculpture.
No, because your tradition is relief sculpture.
And really, our tradition is relief sculptures and sculptures which have been incorporated with architecture.
So are you saying that there is a sense of you breaking with a tradition?
Yes, but then also there is a question that my work is in a different medium. It doesn't lend itself to the pedestal, you know. I think I would be claiming too much if I said what you're saying. You know?
I just wondered also whether you, in a sense, you're breaking from a tradition that is to do with the relief, which we know is traditional.
No, I think I've been very interested in the relief because my work has started from the relief and then later come off the wall. You know, my earlier works were reliefs against the wall. You know, and I think that I have been interested in reliefs.
Could I just explore one other idea to do with installation, which is that of the relationship with place? I wonder to what extent your works have a relationship with the place that they're going to be.
Well, the relationship, like I've done a lot of commissions. These large things are commissions, you know. So then I have done them specifically for a, you know, area. So they are in that sense, they're installations, you know. Or they're not, I mean, they're installations in the sense that if I'm having an exhibition, I have to be there to sort of hang them up, and I like to group them in a certain way. I like to arrange them in a...
So these public commissions, or are these privately?
No, most of them have been public commissions.
Can you talk a little bit about the material you use, which I understand is a natural material, rope?
Yes, it's a natural material which is grown in India. I don't know what the English term for it is. It's something close to hemp, but it's not hemp.
I
don't know whether it's flax, because, you know, it's not jute.
It's
not? No. It's not jute. So it may be flax or hemp or something in between that, you know.
I wondered if you could now elaborate a little bit on the references in the individual works.
You see, I would not like to do that, because I think that my, you know, aesthetics of work is informed by things all over the world, you know, and also Indian things. And I don't like this, you know, thing of particularizing, and because I feel that the work should speak for itself, you know.
But when you decide to make a work, do you have any sort of an idea in your...
I have an idea of the type of image that I want, you know, and then I have to prepare the materials, I have to get them dyed, and I have to start somewhere. But then I let it sort of grow.
Do you make preparatory drawings?
Not really, no.
Is it a misreading to interpret the ones that I've seen in the book that I have as seeming to have a relationship to the human form?
No, I think they all have a relationship to the human form. I think the earlier works were more, I mean, they maybe started with the idea of a plant or some sort of a growth or plants, you know, forms from nature. But they sort of took on a human scale. And gradually, I think they became more human. And I think the last few works are particularly more figurative.
Some of the others seem to remind me more of totems and symbolic images of the human form.
But they're not any particular, I mean, they don't come from any mythology. It may be a personal mythology. They don't come from any traditional mythology.
Right. Is there any, I mean, I don't want to labour this, but is there any relationship between, you know, your interests and Indian relief sculpture, which has a very long tradition? I mean, occasions, there are occasions here where I'm reminded of that tradition.
Well, I mean, those are the things that one, you know, which informs one's aesthetics, because you see a lot of these things. But there are things all over the world, you know, like I respond to Romanesque sculpture.
Mm.
I may not respond to Michelangelo, but,
yes.
You know, it...
The richness of Romanesque carving,
yes.
The intricate, the way things are interleaved and
yes.
Open up. And
the way they are connected with the architecture,
sure.
Is different to, say, the High Renaissance work. You know, there must be so many objects from all over the world and within India that, you know, we have a collective memory of them.
Could we move on to talk about those relationships? Living and working as an artist in India,
yes.
I wondered how you perceived the Western art phenomena of Europe and America, which has a sort of a network and a structure for supporting and
yes,
promoting
but
art.
You know, the whole thing is that here it is supported by the galleries and commerce,
sure.
And things, which in India it is still not, or till now was not. You know? Maybe it will become that way. So in a way we work in a different context. I mean, here, and maybe we have more freedom to work. You know, maybe we don't, I mean, I can still hire a space and have an exhibition, you know,
mm.
Which maybe an artist living in Britain can't do, you know, unless some gallery discovers him or sponsors him or... it must be much more hard for people who leave art schools in England, and maybe after that they are not able to do work.
But do you... I mean, what I'm really getting at is to what extent do you feel any sympathy or empathy toward the preoccupations and content of the work going on in Europe?
You see, sometimes it does, because I feel that now even a lot of the artists have widely travelled, you know, a lot of them are even travelling to India, and a lot of them are being influenced by India.
Sure.
But they will be influenced by India in a different way to an artist living in India, you know. There is a question of the exotic.
Sure.
You know? So, and there are different, there are things that they'll notice there which may be, which are other things that I will notice here which are part of my daily life there. And one is living and working in India out of choice, I think, because a lot of us have had the chance to not, you know, to make a decision of, say, trying to live somewhere else.
Right.
But, I mean, it means a lot to me to be, I wouldn't mind going somewhere and working for a short time, but I know that I want to be living and working in India. To live in India and work in India, I find that most comfortable. And I think that's also more of a, you know, physical thing. My work is very physical. And there is, you know, an involvement of my own body and in doing it, you know, which I find it more comfortable in India. It's just your whole way of using your body is a bit different to living here, say. So this is purely, you know, personal and in the context of my work.
How's the work made? Because it is very, very physical to
yes.
me. I mean, it's very sensuous.
So it is knotted, you know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, sometimes these things are much heavier than me. So it's almost like you're wrestling with another person. And they're not stiff, you know, they...
they flop about.
Yes.
So it's all knotted.
Yes.
And so you start from one sheet or section and then build.
Yes.
Seems in the later pieces, it seems to almost evoke the idea of a ceremonial presence, a ceremonial costume?
Well, I'm interested in the idea of presence, you know. So, and I like it when, you know, I finish something and I get a bit, I almost feel in awe of it, you know.
Right.
Yes.
Can I just explore another idea, which, yeah, forgive me if it's very abstract, but yeah, you were talking about feeling comfortable in your environment and so on, and I just wondered if you could say a bit more about, you know, your relationship as an artist with your environment and the culture within which you're working.
Environment meaning that, you know, access to material. One just knows how to function in one's own, and as I said, it's a physical thing, you know, like, here, one is sitting on some chair in the tube or somebody's house, and one, after a while, you know, my whole body starts spinning and I just want to squat, you know. It is something as simple as
sure,
that, and it's it's a way of life, I suppose, you know. It's and, you know, like, the material I'm using is a, when I started working with it, was a common material, easily available, and not that expensive. Unfortunately, now it's because of plastics and things, you know, it is also not that easy or that. But it was something that I could buy off the streets, just as it's easier for you to buy a can of beer or something, you know, something that you see hanging on the streets, you know.
Right.
So when you're talking about access to, it may not, so like some of the sculptors here, like say if you talk about Bill Woodrow, it might be easier for him to get a washing machine or something like that, you know, but it's not so easy for me to get a dumped washing machine or you know, something.
The artists that you've seen, who we mentioned, Anthony Gormley, David Marr, Anish Kapoor, they're all part of what's known as the New British Sculpture.
Mm.
Do you see much in common between these British sculptors?
Well, one thing one sees in common among them is probably not Gormley, that they are not figurative. Like when they see my work, they say, we like your earlier work more, you know.
What about Richard Long? Have you seen the big Hayward?
I saw the show, and I liked some of the large pieces very much, because I felt that they have an architectural presence.
Do you think, I mean, this is going back a bit to what we were talking about earlier, about the sort of axis of contemporary art and new art and the way it's promoted and exhibited and bought and sold and discussed in the magazines in the West. I mean, have you felt, as an artist working elsewhere, excluded from the debates happening in the West?
No, I don't think one feels, because the debates are mainly about the market, you know. You know, if the debates are about other things, that they may interest us and we may be having the same debates, you know. But I don't know what, we don't have access to that much, that many magazines or that much, you know.
I'm interested to know what, if there was a conversation between yourself and maybe some other artists in India about what are the issues, the priorities, the preoccupations, what that conversation would include.
The painters, they are, lot of the important painters today are preoccupied with their own environment, where they live, their work is quite particularized, you know. And like, I feel very disturbed about what is happening in India now. There's a big upsurge of Hinduism. For me right now, it's a bit difficult to talk about spiritualism. We are having too many, you know, communal tensions which
religious
disturb
tension.
Me. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Most of people I respect in India have consciously, because we have our own tradition. I am interested in my own tradition. I am interested in my own environment, you know. And it is a visual tradition, which, you know, after a while, you know, to me it matters that I go to a different village and see different things, see different shops. I feel uncomfortable that I can travel from here to the next town and I see the same shops and the same things, you know.
Yeah.
And after staying here for a couple of months, I can't stand it anymore, you know. It's but right now, you know, we have a living tradition of craft, we have a living tradition of different types of crafts. We have tribal painters and folk sculptors, and we are functioning in that context, you know. What I do, I would like, if they see my work, that they also get something out of seeing my work.
Henk-Jin, this is an unusual opportunity for people in the UK to find out more about the situation for fine artists in Mongolia after a long period of intellectual isolation as well as geographical isolation. Are things opening up much more, and are you having more opportunities to make contacts with people in other countries?
Yeah, since the changes 3 years ago in Mongolia, we have more possibilities to get in touch with the countries, Western countries, and we will feel free, more or less, to cooperate and to see what happened in Europe and in the rest of the world, including UK. And geographical isolation in Mongolia, you see that we are hidden between two giants, such as Soviet Union and China. And, for example, there is only one railway line going through Soviet Union and through Mongolia till China. And if one have to go by plane, one needs time at least 8 or 9 hours to be in Europe.
Mongolia came under Soviet domination very early, much earlier than many of the Eastern European countries, which are now democracies. 1921, I think. What was the experience for fine artists during that period, from 1921 until 1991, was it, when you had your first elections?
Yeah, in the early periods of the so-called revolution, more or less we have had the continuity of tradition. But the continuity of the tradition was cut during the years of 40s, you know. And after 40s, we have gone to the influence of Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, Russia. And the majority of people were educated in the Soviet Union, and all kind of culture and so on were influenced by the Russians.
So were you as a painter, educated where?
In Germany, in East Germany. East Germany, GDR, the former GDR. And I would like to point out that the possibility is to be educated during the period in Eastern Bloc countries, including Soviet Union, were more or less good opportunities, I think. Mm-hmm. And but now the government is going not much take care of the education, that is the other side of the democracy, but we hope still that the government will do something in this direction.
So one of the things that hasn't improved with the new democratic situation is the quality of education. You think the opportunities were better under the Soviets?
Yes, because of the financial situation of nowadays Mongolia.
What would you say are the current priorities and interests of Mongolian fine artists?
The Mongolian fine artists, they are very interested in getting information from all Western countries. and they are very keen on to travel to the countries and to see all the things happen in Western countries. That is good on the one side. On the other hand, we are going now to the so-called market economy. That causes some kind of problem because some artists are going to commercial art. That's another danger. There are only a few artists who are working on serious art.
To whom do these commercial artists sell their work? How do they manage to find buyers?
Since the changes, East Mongolia more or less open to the world, and a lot of tourists and people coming from the other countries, and they are very keen on Mongolian art.
Before the change in the economic structure, were artists more able, serious artists as you have described them, more able to survive?
I wouldn't like to say that they were more able, but in some kind of extent, the artists' hall, they were it was subsidized by the state. For example, the Union of Mongolian Artists was subsidized by the state, but now we have to survive ourselves.
The Union of Mongolian Artists consisted before the changes of everybody who called themselves an artist. Is that right? I mean, how were they defined?
We have about 400 members.
Now, or has there been any change?
Yeah, a little bit more or mm-hmm. less, I think. But they have to be a member of the Union of Mongolian Artists. One artist have to show himself in exhibitions and so on, then they will be accepted as a member of Mongolian Artists.
In the College of Fine Art, I remember that you told me there were two courses in painting, one of a traditional nature and one, I forget what you call it, but European or whatever, contemporary.
Yeah, as whole, the art in Mongolia, if you would like to see, then one have to know that there are two lines in art. One is the traditional art, and the another one is art affected by the European culture. That is because a lot of artists are educated in Soviet Union and in Eastern Bloc countries. They were sent through the so-called through the years of socialism, and when they come back to Mongolia, they developed some kind of European art or painting. And next to it, we have the traditional Mongolian art in painting, in sculpture, and in decorative art, in handicraft, and so on.
Do you think that traditional Mongolian art in painting and sculpture, for example, is totally separate and unchanged, or is it contributing to, or combining with the European tradition into a new contemporary art?
There are some artists who wants to combine the European tradition with the Mongolian tradition of art, but on my private view of art, I wouldn't like to say that it is possible to combine both kind of art, it would be better if it is separately and go better.
In the books written in Mongolia about painting, which I think were written by your father, Mongol Zurag is referred to as a form of painting which looks at least to be largely concerned with outlines, simple outlines, and filling in with colour. Is that synonymous with traditional Mongolian painting, or in other words, is that traditional Mongolian painting?
Yeah, that is the Mongolian traditional painting. We call it Mongol Zurag. The Mongol Zurag has its own origin thousands of years ago, and it was developed through the history of Mongolia through the years. And nowadays, we hope to develop it as much as it possible. I think the Mongol Zurag has influences in the history by the Tibetan painting, because the Mongol Zurag is very involved with Tibetan culture because of the religion. We have the same religion like the Tibetans, the Lamaism.
Does the term Mongol Zurag then, as a kind of style of painting, include Buddhist, or is it only used in relation to secular art?
In Mongol Zurag you can find both religious paintings and paintings of life, themes of life. In Mongol Zurag you can find both the religious ones and the
secular.
Yes.
Even today?
Yes, even today. Yeah.
So in the College of Fine Art, on the traditional painting course, they teach Mongol Zurag, and it can include both Buddhist or religious and secular work.
But in the art college, not the religious one. Yeah. Only there are schools in monasteries, art schools too. Mm. And there they teach Mongol Zurag involved with religion. But in art college, they teach only Mongol Zurag as art, and the technique, and the colors, and the form, and so on, all such kind of things.
Mongolia has a population of 2 million, approximately.
Yes.
Of which, I believe, 1 million or 1.5 million are still nomads.
Yes.
Do the nomads appreciate the kind of art taught on the in the College of Fine Art on the traditional art course, Mongol Zurag?
Yes, the traditional art, the Mongol Zurag, is better in this direction. But the tradition of European artists is very problematic for those people.
What do you think is the role of art in Mongolia in all this? What does contemporary art have to offer to the people of Mongolia?
Yeah, I think I share the idea, la po la, and the art has its own way, own rules, and the art goes in its own way. But we have to try to make use of the art. But the art is such kind of thing, when the society reaches to a certain level. But we have now facing a lot of problems in economy. If one have no money, then we cannot improve art. The people are interested more for bread and for such kind of things, And I would like to say that art is not bread, and they are interested more for the things of everyday life. That's the pity and problem of the art situation in Mongolia now.
I'm about to interview Mona Hatoum, who has recently shown an installation at the Serpentine Gallery in London entitled Light Sentence. And that is also shown, or a replica of it is shown, as part of a much larger exhibition, solo exhibition of her work at the Arnolfini in Bristol, of which the largest single piece is an installation called Plus or Minus. But to begin with, Mona, could you describe Light Sentence?
Okay, Light Sentence is an installation in which I use lockers, wire mesh lockers, which I've placed in a U-shape enclosure within a room, and there's a light bulb. The only light source in the room is a single light bulb that hangs from a wire, and the light bulb moves very, very slowly up and down. Maybe I'll talk about how this piece came about. I was actually looking for some furniture in an office furniture catalogue, and I identified this wire mesh locker. I immediately could see the associative potential of this wire mesh locker, because for me it looked more like little cages, animal cages, like you would see in a lab or a factory for chicken. And but also it looked like a model of a skyscraper, like an architectural model. The light bulb, for me, emphasized the architectural element of the work. By projecting the shadows onto the surrounding walls, not only it created a sort of feeling of the whole room becoming like a cage in which you become enmeshed, but also this feeling that because the light bulb is moving very, very slowly, the whole environment becomes a very, there's a feeling of disequilibrium, of displacement, disorientation that's created by that sort of simple movement of the light, which shifts the ground under your feet and gives you that very uneasy feeling when you enter the space that something is not quite right. But it's also got some very poetic, I feel, it's very meditative and poetic and beautiful, because there's shadows on the walls that, of course, the wire mesh lockers are very rigid and solid and very much there. But the shadows become very liquid and fluid, and they can be very beautiful to watch, just sort of going up and down on the wall.
Now, Plus or Minus is a much bigger installation. Could you briefly describe that, and then we can talk about some of the shifts in your work?
The main space downstairs at the Arnolfini has one continuous wall, which is about 40 feet long, and which I clad entirely with sheets of metal, from floor to ceiling, and at a right angle to the wall there are two columns and I put sheets of metal, glass sheets going from the floor to the ceiling again. And from a distance, when you walk into the space, you see a regular pattern of little rectangles which look like a drawing, maybe a flat drawing on the wall, on the metal wall, and the same is repeated on the glass wall. When you come close to it, you realize that it is little things stuck on the surface, and they have a very funny, fuzzy texture to it, which is actually made with iron filings clustering around magnets that are stuck on the surface very regularly in a grid form. From a distance, it looks like a nice, clean drawing. But when you come very close, these objects, these things stuck on, start looking like little creepy animals or some sort of virus or some sort of mushroom that's grown on the surface. And so it's not anymore those nice, clean surfaces that you expect.
Now, I know that throughout your career, you've used different media and different styles, and that is still the case. But speaking very generally, there does seem to be a shift of emphasis away from more literal, figurative and referential imagery towards a cooler, more abstract, more elegant and more spare look. Do you think that's fair? And if so, why do you think it is?
In my recent work, I think the material that I'm dealing with is still very much the same, but the physical embodiment of it has become maybe more sophisticated and more precise and more exploring the enjoyment of materials and the phenomenology of these materials that I use or the space. I think maybe I feel like I don't have to tell the whole story, the whole very complicated story in every piece of work anymore. For me, a work has to function on different levels. What I'm always aiming with in my work is to try and sort of maybe create a situation which involves you in some way, maybe in a very basic way physically. Sort of maybe just a situation which seduces you or engages you in some way physically and on a very basic level. But then the questions come after.
Well, there were several associations in plus or minus, to stay with that one for a moment. The most obvious one, or most obvious to me in the title, especially given the presence of iron filings on magnets, was electromagnetism.
Maybe if I tell you of some of the titles that I was about to use for this piece, and like the working title for it was The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Somewhat different.
Absolutely, and it was just a working title. The other one was Viral Statistics, as opposed to Vital Statistics. Another one was Pole to Pole, because there were two columns. But also I was trying to work with this idea of something which is very, very regimented and organized, but at the same time invasive, and is something that we can't control maybe, and has invaded an area, has infested an area.
It's interesting that you speak in terms of infestation. I must say, I didn't pick that up in Bristol myself. They looked so evidently metallic. I didn't see them as sort of living things. But I was very struck by what were, in effect, two wire chairs upstairs, an untitled piece, two sort of wire grid-like structures looking like very simple chairs, one very much larger than the other. And they were obviously in some sort of relationship with each other. And very recent work, a work still in progress, which you've just showed me in your studio, includes a pair of swings. Well, a piece is called A Couple, brackets of swings. And there's another work which also consists of two plaques, which is called Hearing Voices. But again, there's this coupling, this having of things in twos. And you were saying that, in fact, you felt you might be dealing with relationships, at one level, relationships between people, and in the same breath, which I haven't thought of at all, you mentioned AIDS and said that that might be one of the associations.
Well, if I go back to the wire chairs, which look very cage-like, it's two chairs, one is an adult chair, one is a child's chair. So you immediately have these sort of relationships of small and large, maybe mother and child or father and child, but this sort of entrapment of the two being made of wire mesh, like cages. There's something very harsh about them because they are very angular and very cold. But at the same time, there's something very touching and sweet about them. And I always, talking about dualities, I really like to explore always like, or move people in two different directions at the same time, maybe a positive and a negative, or something sort of like cold and uncaring and at the same time warm and caring, as in the case of the two chairs. I always like to explore those sort of opposites in every piece of work. I mean, a piece could be very seductive and at the same time very repulsive. You know, that's something I like to explore quite a bit. Why I mentioned AIDS, in relation to, I mean, I feel it's very much part of our language nowadays. It's sort of, it's responsible for a lot of the body art that's happening at the moment, but it's also responsible for making us realize how vulnerable we are. and this combination of the maybe thinking about the amorous body and the diseased body in one image is something that I find quite weird and scary and strange at the same time. So the two swings for me, I called them a couple of swings because they're two swings, obviously fragile because they're made of glass, and if they swung towards each other, they can smash each other. They can touch each other, but they can smash each other at the same time. So that's why I'm sort of talking about that sort of vulnerability of the body, whether it's to do with AIDS or any kind of vulnerability. But, you know, I mean, any type of closeness, you can smash each other as well. So it's not necessarily just to do with AIDS.
Could we talk a little about the way in which you would like your work to function on the spectator? If you feel that it's no longer valid to use things with too strong references, but you're now using these much sparer systems, do you feel that it's going to be working in a different way on the people who receive it?
I mean, to a certain extent, sort of the unconscious is unavoidable because, I mean, like my social condition as a woman from a distant culture with all the influences and all the experiences that I grew up with in Lebanon has formed my unconscious. And that's related to the social context I grew up in and the experiences I had. And the older I get, the more I realize that a lot of my work actually makes reference to maybe a couple of incidents that happened to me as a child, which were obviously directly related to the context I was growing up with, which is sort of with the threat of war and all that stuff around me. Now, although for a long time I felt I was making very clear and specific political statements, the emphasis in those works, to me, related completely to those incidents. And it's only after creating a series of works that I can look back and think, ah, well, this is related to this, and this is related to that.
There was another small piece in your show at Bristol called Incommunicado, which was a strange little structure, also quite cage-like in a sense. It reminded me slightly of a hospital trolley or cot or something like that.
It is actually a hospital cot. It's a sort of a cold bare metal hospital cot, and the frame is very prison-like. It's got bars.
It means actually ready-made.
It's actually a ready-made, which I ordered with my own specifications. To me, it speaks very much of child abuse, if you like, on one level. But I called it Incommunicado because I feel that when a child is in that situation, they do not have the language and the ability to communicate what that pain and the terror they're going through. But I also feel that even as an adult, if you go through terrifying experiences of pain or abuse, there isn't a language to articulate it. You turn into a little infant who is unable to articulate, because in the enormity of pain, for me, is contained within the boundaries of the body and remains private and incommunicable.
I was wondering in particular about your tape Measures of Distance, which, when I was watching it, even though I didn't catch every word, even in the English translation, because it's got an Arabic soundtrack and also an English soundtrack, which is sort of overlaid, the English translating the Arabic, even though I didn't catch it all, it seemed to be extremely painful, and it was dealing with a very personal situation of communication, particularly between yourself and your mother. And I wondered whether, in fact, it was a very painful thing to make.
So in this work, I made a conscious decision to deal with the personal, to tell my story, if you like, which is a very complex story. The way I structured it is that it's based on a series of letters from my mother to myself. My mother still lives in Beirut, and me living in London, and the sort of the distance between us, which was caused by the war in Lebanon. And so although it's sort of based on the relationship between mother and daughter, it also speaks of loss and disorientation and exile, and it sort of becomes like a portrait of a person who's trying to make sense of the refractions of exile and displacement, trying to reconstruct an identity for herself out of all those discontinuities, if you like.